different aspects of what might eventually become quantum gravity phenomenology. And in case I forget to give due reference to my collaborators during the course of the talk, here are some of them. So a bunch of theorists, but also, as you notice, a couple of experimental collaborations. And one of the fun things about doing this sort of business is that we've succeeded in fooling a couple of experimental groups into doing joint analyses with us, and I'll discuss those analyses as we go along. Okay, so the outline of my talk is I'll start off by mentioning what I at least think to be some of the most important issues in quantum gravity. Then I'll discuss a few topics which might possibly turn out to be phenomenological signatures of quantum gravity. One of them is a possible modification of quantum mechanics. This is, of course, an idea that goes back to the early 1980s or late 1970s, at least, with Stephen Hawking. And some years ago, we actually did an experimental analysis of data on kaons with the C.P. O'Leary collaboration. So I'd like to remind you not only of why we think that testing quantum mechanics is an interesting thing to do, but also how one actually does it in practice. Now, in the early 1990s, we developed a way of trying to do phenomenological quantum gravity based on a non-critical approach to string theory. So I'll mention a little bit of time discussing that, although the actual experimental tests that I'm going to be discussing don't depend critically on non-critical string. In recent years, one of the topics that we've been particularly interested in is a possible modification of Lorentz invariants. So specifically, the idea that we've been looking at is the possibility that the velocity of light might depend on the frequency of the light, or if you prefer, the energy of the corresponding photon. And I'll give some reasons later on for why one might imagine that this could be the case. We'd expect an effect which perhaps would increase like some power of energy. So what you would like, ideally, if you want to probe this effect, would be energetic sources of photons. If you're looking for a difference in propagation speed, you want to get a large propagation distance. And so that means you'd like to look at astrophysical objects. So in fact, we've done a couple of analyses of gamma ray bursters and active galactic nuclei, and I'll present some results from those. Now, one question that you might then ask is, okay, if the velocity of light depends on the energy, is the same also true for the velocities of other particles? If you take, say, an electron at extremely high energy, does it travel at the same speed as light or not? So this comes down to what one wants to ask, whether there is a violation of the equivalence principle. Perhaps this is not the classical way of thinking about the equivalence principle, but you understand what I mean. The particles of very high energies don't necessarily travel at the speed of light. Well, we actually think, at least in our approach, that the effect that we're talking about would show up preferentially for photons and not for electrons. And I'll try to explain why that's the case. Phenomenologically, this is important because actually there are very stringent limits on the violation of Lorentz invariants for electrons coming from astrophysical sources. And then I also say a few words towards the end about other ways in which our ideas could be applied, for example, to cosmological inflation, and if time permits, a different approach to the dark energy issue. Okay, so one could try to group problems of quantum gravity, very roughly speaking, into two groups. One is issues that arise in perturbation theory. And though it's well known that, superficially at least, gravity is a non-normalizable theory and you get horrible infinities when you calculate things in perturbation theory. A completely different set of issues has to do with what you might describe as non-perturbative issues. If you've got a non-perturbative configuration such as a black hole, could this black hole cause pure quantum mechanical states to evolve into mixed states. And in fact, historically, this was the first potential signature of quantum gravity that interested Hawking, and some years later interested me and my collaborators. Of course, it's a very different issue, as I've emphasized, from whether or not you can do reliable perturbative calculations. Now, at least, you know, back when Hawking started thinking about it, he, I think, was of the opinion that quantum gravity was perhaps incompatible with conventional quantum mechanics. Nowadays, his viewpoint seems to have evolved for reasons that I find impenetrable. Anyway, I consider it still an interesting phenomenological question, whether or not quantum mechanics behaves in the way that we expect. Okay, so another important aspect in what I'll be talking about is the idea that the vacuum in quantum gravity should not be regarded as some fixed background. Indeed, you know, all the way back to Wheeler, well, back quite possibly before I was born, certainly before most of you were born, there have been speculations that the fabric of space-time should exhibit quantum fluctuations. And so, very roughly speaking, the idea would be that if you look on time scales or distance scales, which are of order 1 in natural Planckian units, then you would expect fluctuations in energy density of the order of 1, and quite possibly also topological fluctuations of the order of 1. And this is the idea which Wheeler christened space-time foam. So in this picture, you have an idea of what this might look like. You look at space-time on a sufficiently large scale, and it looks flat. But then as you increase the power of your microscope and you look more and more carefully, you find that it actually starts wiggling around on small distance scales. And eventually, maybe it becomes very complicated. So the issue with which I'm mainly going to be concerned in this talk is whether, if this happens, it has any potentially testable, observable manifestations. I'm not even sure whether one could really regard space-time foam as being an established theoretical idea. Certainly many people feel that it's something that they can neglect, but I would certainly hope that it cannot be neglected. Whether one could actually see manifestations of it, of course, is a different matter. Okay, well, this is a bit of blah, blah, blah. Let's move on. So, my point of view in this is that if one wants to combine general relativity with quantum mechanics, then very likely, or very possibly, perhaps I should say, one or the other, or quite possibly both, must be modified. And so, in fact, the sort of common thread of the subsequent slides will be, you know, looking for, on the one hand, modifications of relativity, and on the other side, modifications of quantum mechanics. So these are the topics which I've already mentioned. Modification of quantum mechanics, as I think Nick has already reminded you, violation of quantum mechanics, at least in the sort of way in which we would imagine doing it, entailed necessarily also a violation of CPT, not in a sort of naive way, but related to the loss of information that we think might possibly happen in quantum gravity. And as I mentioned, violation of Lorentzian, modification of Lorentzian invariants in our approach would necessarily be accompanied by a breakdown of the equivalence principle, not only in our theoretical approach, but also on the basis of astrophysical data. Perhaps one last general comment is, of course, one could imagine looking for other, you know, less radical signatures of quantum gravity. I think one of the things that I'm interested in is looking for things which absolutely could not happen within the framework of conventional quantum field theory. Something which, if you actually saw this effect, then this would really be a smoking gun for some sort of quantum gravity phenomenon. Now, it could very well be that there are other phenomena which do arise in a quantum theory of gravity but are not so radical. But to the extent that they're not so radical, they're not so interesting. Okay, so with apologies to Lee, I'm going to be mainly working in the framework of string theory. Many of the issues which I'm going to be talking about can be addressed using other theoretical frameworks, indeed have been addressed using other theoretical frameworks, but I'm not an expert in string theory. I'm certainly not an expert in those other frameworks, so I'm not going to look at it from that point of view. So I think one of the most interesting developments in string theory over the last decade has been much greater technical control over non-perturbative configurations, so-called D-brains and related phenomena. And from time to time during the course of my talk, I will sort of make appeal to D-brain calculations as examples of the sorts of things that we think might happen. Now, another comment that I would make is that most string theorists uncritically work in critical string theory. So they make sure that they're in the right number of dimensions, so they have a space-time interpretation for the space in which the string moves. So our point of view would be that within string theory, if you want to discuss these microscopic fluctuations in space-time, then you have to go beyond this critical formulation of string theory. And so this is one of the basic things that we have in the backs of our minds, although, as I said, these phenomenological tests of quantum gravity might possibly arrange in other frameworks. Okay, so down to business. Is quantum mechanics modified? So Nick already spent quite a lot of his talk discussing this with you. So there's going to be obviously a lot of overlap between what I'm going to say and what Nick is going to say. But I think that we'll address it from somewhat different points of view, certainly with a different accent. So everybody knows that macroscopic black holes are mixed states. They obey the laws of thermodynamics, non-zero temperature, non-zero entropy, and information is lost across the horizon. And it is often thought that one could, in principle, manufacture a black hole from a pure initial state. For example, the previous talk by Greg, if he raised his eyes from his screen, this is exactly what he was doing, right? He was colliding two quarks or two gluons or something, and he was making a black hole, and then this was decaying into lots and lots of particles. So I think, Greg, that you were violating quantum mechanics. In fact, it was on the tip of my tongue to ask you during your talk whether you had any way of testing whether or not your black hole was decaying as a pure state. This would be fantastically exciting if it was not the case. And I think that most of the Monte Carlo simulations implicitly assume that indeed pure states are evolving into mixed states, which of course would be a violation of quantum mechanics. Well, I say violation of quantum mechanics, a violation of our naive understanding of quantum mechanics. Okay, so the question is whether this sort of modification of quantum mechanics occurs at a microscopic scale. So Greg's experiments would be one example. I'm going to be discussing other possible probes using two-particle systems, such as kaons and related things, a topic which Nick already introduced. So the question is, why should quantum mechanics be modified at the microscopic level? So here, the basic idea is that you come back to your space-time foam, and here you can see I googled some particularly nice pieces of space-time foam, that maybe there are topological fluctuations in there, and maybe when you sum over the possible configurations through which a process takes place, that some information might be lost through the event horizons associated with some non-trivial topological fluctuation. Now, indeed, this was what Hawking proposed back in 1982, and what he had in mind was to look for transitions between in-states and out-states which would not obey the normal quantum mechanical rules. Well, the normal quantum mechanical rule is an in-state is related to an out-state by an element of the S matrix, and he suggested, well, maybe you should think in terms of density matrices which can describe mixed states as well as pure states, and then you would have a linear operator which relates your in the mixed state, your out mixed state, so-called dollar operator, and in conventional quantum mechanics that dollar operator could be written as a product of an S and an S dagger. But he said, well, maybe that's not the case, maybe your dollar matrix is not factorizable, might be perhaps writable as a sum of SS dagger, a sum over individual Fermi configurations, for example, but it would not be directly factorizable as a product of an S and an S dagger. So this, as I understand it, was Stephen's original proposal, which, as I said, you know, maybe he's now retracted. Just because he might have retracted it doesn't mean to say that we have to retract it, but so, in fact, the reason why I got interested in this subject in the first place was by putting together two of Hawking's papers. One was this speculation that you maybe shouldn't be using the S matrix, but the dollar matrix. And the other one was a two-page paper. Back in those days, it was possible to write two-page papers, in which he proposed that microscopic black holes might also cause protons to decay. So here the idea is you've got a black hole, you've got an event horizon, you can forget about your baryon number, and so one possible example might be that two quarks inside a proton would go inside a black hole and Hawking radiate out as an antiquark and a lepton, and bingo, you've got proton decay, and he estimated what the lifetime would be. So in a conventional non-supersymmetric theory, that would be pretty long and unobservable. But we realized that in the case of supersymmetry, there are other operators which can give you proton decay, which could give you a much shorter lifetime. So we wrote a paper about this, and as a sort of footnote comment in this paper, we realized that, okay, if this idea of Hawking was correct, and if the other idea of Hawking was correct too, then you might actually see some non-quantum mechanical effect in proton decay. Now, I have absolutely no idea how you would actually test for this, okay. But well, actually I have some ideas about how you might test for it, but let's first of all see proton decay before we figure out how to test whether quantum mechanics is violated there. Anyway, but this got me interested in the idea that violation of quantum mechanics might be something that one could think about. Now, as I said, Hawking considered the transition from asymptotic in-states to asymptotic out-states. What we did together with John Hagel and Dimitri Nonopoulos and Mark Sognicki in 1983 was consider what happens at sub-asymptotic times. So you consider timescales which are large compared with the Planck scale, so large compared with these little fluctuations that might be taking place, but not asymptotic. Now, normally, in quantum mechanics, you would describe that using a Hamiltonian, and the evolution equation for the density matrix is just given by the commutator of the density matrix with a Hamiltonian, and you integrate that up, and you get the S matrix. So what we said, well, if you're not going to get an S matrix, if instead you're going to get a dollar matrix, then there has to be some additional piece in the linear time evolution equation for the density matrix. So we said, well, okay, maybe in addition to the commutator of the density matrix with the Hamiltonian, there is an additional non-commutator piece, this thing which I call delta H slash. Then it's easy to verify that in this case entropy increases in general, and roughly speaking, the increase in the entropy is given by the norm of this linear operator, delta H slash. So how big might such an effect be? Well, it's clearly not of order one, otherwise we wouldn't have been learning quantum mechanics for the last 100 years. So it's going to be suppressed by presumably at least one power of M Planck. And both in this first paper and in some subsequent papers, we gave some reasons why, under some circumstances at least, this effect might be suppressed by only one power of M Planck. And then by dimensional analysis, if you're talking about something which is a linear operator with the dimensions of energy, then it would go like E squared over M Planck. So I wouldn't claim that we've got any calculation that shows this effect, but this is somehow the maximum that the effect could be. Now, we gave a very simple two-state system example in our paper, and I won't go through the details of this maybe, but you can write down a general parameterization of what this non-quantum mechanical data H slash piece might look like, and then you can solve trivially the evolution equation for the density matrix, and you find something which looks like this. So here I've got a couple of components of the density matrix. In normal quantum mechanics, these just rotate into one another and entropy is conserved. However, it's easy to check that if you have non-trivial delta H slash elements, then the density matrix spirals in to the middle, and this spiraling into the middle, that's an irreversible evolution which corresponds to a loss of information and increase in entropy. Okay, now, this point I would comment on something which we didn't immediately pick up on at the time, but there was some papers by Page and Wald which pointed out that if you have this sort of non-trivial dollar matrix evolution, then you necessarily have CPT violation. And the argument is relatively simple. If you define the standard CPT operator, then if this is a good transformation, then the dollar matrix has an inverse. And conversely, if the dollar matrix is singular, which is what happens in the previous example that I just showed, it has no inverse, and if it has no inverse, then you can't define this CPT operator. So it's in this sense that CPT is violated, and you can think of it as being related to the loss of information or the non-reversible evolution of the system. Okay, so already back in 1983, we considered the possible application of this to simple two-state systems, such as, for example, the K0, K-bar zero system. And the formalism is very simple, similar to what I just wrote down for the two-state system a while back. It's a little bit complicated because you have to take account of the decay matrix of the kaons as well as the mass matrix and so on. But there's nothing really intrinsically complicated to it. Again, you get these parameters which characterize the potential non-Hamiltonian evolution of the system. And then you can consider what would happen to certain observables in the kaon system. So the kaons decay in various different ways. Sometimes they decay into two pions, sometimes they decay into three pions, sometimes they decay into a pi electron neutrino, and you can consider what might be the implications for those observables in this sort of non-quantum mechanical evolution. Well, I won't go through the details of that. Instead, I'll cut straight to the chase. These are some results from a paper that we wrote a decade or so ago with the C.P. Lear collaboration, who had lots and lots of data on kaon decays, including 2 pi decays and pi e nu decays. And so we did a joint analysis of the constraints that one could apply on these possible non-Hamiltonian evolution terms, alpha, beta, and gamma. And the impressive thing is that you get sensitivity to these things at the level of, I don't know, 10 to the minus 20 GeV or so. Okay, so this tells you that, you know, quantum mechanics is pretty damn good, right? I mean, quantum mechanics is working at the level of 1 part in 10 to the 20 for the neutral kaon system. Now, I remind you that the maximum that the sort of effect that we were thinking about could be is of the order of E squared, in this case the mass of the kaon squared, divided by M Planck. So what's impressive is that these limits are actually getting down to that level. And so you might hope that if you just did a somewhat more precise kaon experiment, then you might be able to, you know, really see something. However, although there have been several kaon experiments since then, none of them has equaled the precision of the C.P. Lear experiment. And there have also been some experiments on B-mesons. I'm not sure, Nick, did you discuss? No, okay. Those don't seem to be so sensitive. So I actually think that here there's an opportunity for some smart young guy who can figure out a way of pushing the sensitivity of this type of experiments. A couple of orders of magnitude would be very interesting.
But unfortunately, the machine is not
working. Oh. Okay, so that was phenomenological exploration number one. Now a little theoretical interlude. So I mentioned that we developed this non-critical string approach together with Nick and Dimitri, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time discussing that. It's not strictly necessary for the logical flow, but it gives you some idea of, you know, why we are as crazy as we are. Okay. So the idea is that you make a formulation of string theory as a sigma model on the string world sheet, and you consider perturbation of this string model by set of operators. In particular, consider modification by an operator which is not strictly marginal, but has some non-trivial scaling dimension. Now, we're told that conformal invariance is sacred in string theory. So, okay, fine, we restore conformal invariance by dressing the theory with a Liouville field phi, and this appropriate exponential of phi then restores the conformal invariance. So in other words, it's not conformal invariance with the original fields that you thought you had, but you just add in an additional field which then restores the conformal invariance. Now, because the theory without Liouville is not conformally invariant, this means it's got non-trivial renormalization. And okay, so you've got non-trivial beta functions reflecting the fact that the perturbation is not strictly marginal. Okay, now, supposing you consider formally such a system, and let's consider the equation of motion that you would get for the density matrix. Now, it's known that if you look at the effective action of such a sigma model formulation of string theory, then you can consider the effective action that's equivalent to the Zamolodchikov C function. Your world sheet signal model is supposed to be renormalizable, so you write down the condition for the thing to be renormalizable, and you can then regroup the terms on the right hand side, and you find that you get the normal terms which correspond to the commutator of rho with Hamiltonian, so the normal thing that you get in quantum mechanics which integrates up to an S matrix. But you get an additional term, and this additional term is related to these non-trivial beta functions.
There is, at the moment, still not your time, is the normalization group scale, I suppose.
Right, but you identified that.
Well, yeah, but you didn't say that.
Well, I didn't say that. I'm not sure that I was going to say it either, but... Okay, because I wasn't going to go through all the technical details. But the point that I wanted to get across is that this modification of quantum mechanics, this non-Hamiltonian evolution, is directly related to the presence of non-zero beta functions. And another thing which I'm not going to say is that this turns out to be a well-defined quantum mechanical system when you consider higher genus corrections.
Why does it matter with quantum mechanics? Is there an intuitive... because there are non-conformal field theories that perfectly do not violate quantum mechanics, right? So why?
Well, yeah, it's perhaps an unfortunate terminology. In what sense does it violate quantum mechanics? In fact, the world sheet is described by a perfectly sensible quantum field theory, right? The point is, what happens when you try to elevate that quantum field theory to space-time? Okay, and it's in the elevation that you get an apparent modification of what we normally understand quantum mechanics to do for you. Okay, but on the world sheet, it's perfectly normal quantum field theory. Not that crazy. Quite. No, that's fine. Okay. I've been called crazy. I've been called many worse things than that. I don't mind. So this is just saying that we actually constructed various examples of systems that do this for you. And this is just one particular system that we constructed a few years ago together with one of Nick's ex-students who subsequently went into the City of London, is probably earning more than this entire room. Here you can see a system of D-brains, and if you consider a static system, then this thing is critical. But if you consider the motion of this system, then the system becomes non-critical. So in this particular instance, the relative velocities of these D-brains would be a measure of the degree of non-criticality. I'll come back to this particular example later on. Okay, so so this is what I just said, you know, two slides ago, right? That we have quantum field theory on the world sheet, but there is an obstruction when you try to elevate this to space-time. Okay, so what I'm going to be mainly looking at in the rest of this talk is whether this gives rise to a violation of Lorentz invariance, and whether this violation of Lorentz invariance depends on particle species, and therefore you could consider it to be a violation of the equivalence principle. You could also apply this idea to consider inflation and dark energy. And in fact, this example I just showed of those D-brains can be regarded as a model for either inflation or dark energy. Now, I may come back to that at the end. Okay. Modify Lorentz invariance. Must be crazy. Okay. So, the basic intuition here is that we believe, maybe, that you've got these fluctuations in the space-time background, so you've got the space-time chrome. The vacuum is a non-trivial medium with large intrinsic fluctuations at small scales. And since it's a non-trivial dynamical medium, you might expect that if you send something through it, then there'll be some non-trivial interaction between the probe, which is sending through, and the medium, which is being penetrated by the probe. And so there might be some back reaction from the space-time probe on the propagating particle. And it's this that we suggested might give rise to a non-trivial refractive index. In other words, an energy, or if you prefer, frequency-dependent velocity of light. Now, any such effect should presumably be negligible at low energies or low frequencies, which is, after all, where the velocity of light is measured. But you might expect that it would increase with energy. And the original suggestion that we considered was that it might depend linearly on the energy or the frequency. There have also been suggestions that it might be quadratic. And I will discuss later on what experimental constraints you can impose on a possible quadratic modification, as well as the linear modification. Now, it so happens that in the model that I introduced three slides back, this effect is negative. In other words, more energetic particles move slower than the low energy velocity of light. This is actually necessary, I think, because if not, if you travel faster than the low energy velocity of light, then presumably you would have uncontrollable Cherenkov radiation by energetic particles. So I think it's actually necessary that this effect should be negative rather than positive. No. We're just considering the energies of individual quanta, right? Not individual quanta, yes. So point-like particles, not extended objects. Because presumably this effect will be related to, in some sense, to the energy density associated with this energetic particle. And the soccer ball has a lot of energy, but it's spread out. Well, presumably the effect would be actually associated with the individual quarks or gluons inside the proton rather than the proton itself. I think that's the appropriate thing to consider. Well, yeah, I would not do so because the composite object, as I said, is spread out, so the energy density is diffused. In fact, in our approach, as I hope to discuss later on, the constituents of composite particles do not exhibit this effect. It's only the photon that exhibits this effect. Yeah. Which one did I screw up? Oh, yeah. I apologize. These equations, obviously, I cut and pasted from one of our old papers, and it's true that paper had a misprint. Lee. Let me come back to that in a moment. Okay. So then you might ask yourself, what is the possible magnitude of this effect? So we scale it by some parameter over the dimension of energy or mass, which might be of the order of the Planck mass, or it might, in some D-brain system, be the mass of the D-brain. And I believe that Nick did go in exhausting detail through some D-brain calculation. So I summarize this description very briefly here. So we imagine that you can characterize the space-time foam in terms of an assemblage of D-brains, specifically D0 particles, and that these are configured initially in such a way that the mean vacuum energy is zero. Then you propagate a particle through, and every once in a while it interacts with one of these D-brains. And this would then cause the D-brain to recoil, and this recoil of the D-brain would change the metric. It would change the metric by an amount which is suppressed by the mass of the D-brain. And when you've got a metric which is modified in this way, it has an off-diagonal entry in the metric, then you can write down the corresponding Maxwell equations in this modified metric, and then you could calculate the dispersion relation of the photon, and you'll find that it does get this energy-dependent modification. Now, in fact, this calculation of the modified Maxwell equations can be found in Landau and Lifshitz. I forget which page, but somewhere in Landau and Lifshitz you can find them. Okay, so now to come to Lee's question. So in this particular calculation that we did indeed have a preferred reference frame. So you might think of this as being, some cosmological reference frame. We're in some Big Bang scenario, and so there is some Machian reference frame, and so this is relative to that. And this calculation that we did, I think, implicitly contains this picture. I actually have in the back of my mind that one should be able to make a better formulation. This is not something that we've been able to do. At the moment, we are stuck in this reference frame, which is fine because, you know, we are stuck in this reference frame. But I actually think it should be possible to formulate it in a different way. And I have actually in the back of my mind some idea that one has to completely revisit the idea of phase space in a true theory of quantum gravity with non-trivial back reaction. But we have not done that. Do you agree with what I just said, Nick?
Probably is independent.
So we have aspirations and we have reality. Okay, so.
From the chairman, if I may take 1 second to say, we heard this morning from Florian that, you know, when he had his measurements, he had to put a quantum reference frame. So to me, the deep particles could play the role, if you like, of this, because that's what induces the recoil, and that's what makes the measurement, if you like, of this quantum mechanics. So you may not have a background dependent at the end, I don't know. I would like to have it.
Okay, so shortly after we proposed this crazy idea, we teamed up with Subir Sarkar and tried to figure out how you would probe this possible effect astrophysically. And so you look for time delays in energetic photons coming from distant objects. The higher the energy, the better. The more distant the object, the better. And you want to look for objects which have relatively fine time structures in their emission patterns, which then you would compare the arrival times of these features in different energy or frequency bins. So we thought about various astrophysical sources, gamma ray bursters, pulsars, active galaxies, and so on. And typical sensitivities, you just put in the numbers, distances, energies, and the time scales of the emission mechanisms, and you get, you know, some quite interesting sensitivities, you know, 10 to the 15, 16 GeV. Okay. So various people, you know, we and others have analyzed specific types of astrophysical source. Let me just mention a few of the analyses that that I've been involved with together with Nick and Dimitri. So one is analysis of gamma ray bursters. So gamma ray bursters are great because they have extremely large redshift, 5, some of them have been seen. Also, some of them have extremely complicated emission structures. So this is one particular example. You can see there's all sorts of nice little features there which occur on fractions of a second interval. And so that's Sasha Sakharov proposed a technique for analyzing this using wavelets, which are a fancy way of analyzing noisy signals. And we've done a couple of analyses of these. The first one we did back in 2002. We didn't find any significant effect. More recently, we teamed up with Edward Sarkisian, and we put out an analysis of a few dozen gamma ray bursters from three different experiments. Now, it should be said that when we did this analysis, we did it wrong. And this was just recently pointed out to us by Tzvi Piran, who pointed out to us that we didn't treat the redshift quite correctly. So now we've done it correctly, we think, and actually we get a better lower limit. And the lower limit from this analysis is about 10 to the 16 GeV on a possible linear modification of the velocity of light. Now, one of the bugbears in this business is that you have to try to discriminate between effects at the source, and maybe energetic photons just get emitted later, or maybe they get slowed down as they propagate. How can you distinguish the two? So this is the idea for looking at an object at very large redshift, because the source effect would be independent of redshift, but the propagation effect would be linearly dependent on redshift. So this sounds fine in principle, but in practice, you get a strong correlation when you actually do a statistical analysis. And this actually illustrates it for you. This is the, if you like, the probability distribution in a space which consists of the propagation effect and the source effect. And you see that you can't be sure whether there is no source effect and a significant quantum gravity effect, or whether there's no quantum gravity effect but some effect at the source. Certainly, if you have an individual source, you can't tell the difference. And even if you've got many sources, the problem of distinguishing the two effects is quite tricky. Okay, so earlier on this year, we set the logosphere ablaze with an analysis of data from an active galactic nucleus. So this was based on observations by the MAGIC collaboration of a particular AGN called Markarian 501, which is not at a particularly large redshift, but was kind enough to exhibit a couple of flares. So here you are. This is the flaring at the peak compared with the background level. In fact, only one of these flares could be used for this analysis because the other one didn't show up in the high energy data. So what we did was we analyzed in particular this flare over here. What's the time scale? I'll show you in a second. Okay. So this is now in minutes. Right? Okay. So the shock horror exciting thing, which was commented by MAGIC in their original paper, is that if you look at the high energy bin, they did an analysis binned in both photon energy and time. And they binned in, roughly speaking, 4-minute bins. Okay? And what they observed was a shift to later times of the highest energy bin. And in the original draft of their paper, they actually commented that this would be interesting to look at from the point of view of quantum gravity. So we teamed up with them to do such an analysis. Now, instead of binning the data in either energy or in time, what we did was an analysis using the individual energies and the individual arrival times of each photon. So in other words, maximizing the use of information. And the analysis was based on the intuition that if you have any non-trivial dispersion relation, then it disperses. Right? So if you've got a flare, it tends to spread out if you've got a non-trivial dispersion relation. So conversely, you can take the arrival times of the photons, and then you can propagate them backwards using some guess as the quantum gravity scale. And then if you choose the right quantum gravity scale, then all the data will squeeze up into a nice peak. Okay, so it's a little bit more complicated than that because you don't know exactly what the energy is because there are measurement errors and so on. But the basic intuition was to scan in the value of the quantum gravity scale and try to find the value which would maximize the peaking. So this is a couple of figures taken from our paper. So like I said, you don't know, there are measurement errors. So we actually did 1,000 Monte Carlo samples with various different realizations of the stochastic errors in the energy measurement. And for any given measurement, like for example this one over here, then you get a peaking of the energy at some particular value for the time delay GeV. And that actually corresponds to a non-zero time shift for the energetic photons. This is in one particular Monte Carlo realization. So you do this 1,000 times, and you get a histogram. And you see that zero shift is not excluded, although it does look like it's disfavored. Okay, so this is the statistically most powerful analysis that we could come up with, which actually confirms the naive analysis that the MAGIC collaboration did originally. It looks like there is a shift, although you can't be absolutely sure. So, we in our paper did not claim that there was an effect. And we explicitly said that the zero effect was compatible with the data better than the 5% level. We quoted one sigma ranges for the quantum gravity scale for either a linear or a quadratic modification. And we gave a lower limit on the possible quantum gravity scale, but we did not quote an upper limit on the quantum gravity scale, which did not prevent the bloggers from going apeshit. Anyway, they've often said that there's no such thing as bad publicity. Anyway, and another comment that we made in the paper was that we could not distinguish a possible source effect and a possible propagation effect, because we only have one object with one flare. So it would be nice to have more objects with more flares.
To make wrong statements about our result as well. It's not only the blockers.
That where it was coming from, there was basically somewhere written that there was a signal for the coefficient of violation of order one. No? So they were even stating a number. I was curious where they put the numbers in your analysis, because I didn't see it in the paper, in this paper you're citing.
Yeah, I don't know. At some point, I gave up trying to follow the blogs because it would have become a full-time occupation. And I had other things to do. Actually, in retrospect, I might have been better employed spending more time looking at the blogs, but that's a different story.
One sigma preferred range, five orders of magnitude below the limit you set from AGN, is it the same energy range for the photons or not?
This is actually more stringent than any other limit.
Oh, that's for quadratic dispersion.
Yeah, yeah. This is by far the best for quadratic dispersion. Okay, now I said that we weren't able to distinguish source effects in general, although we were able to exclude the possibility that we were just seeing some trivial thermodynamic QED plasma effect. And we commented in the paper that it would be nice to do the analysis with other AGNs, if you like, paralleling what we did with the GRBs earlier on. And in fact, there is another AGN which has been observed to flare. This is something called PKS2155CO4. And this is great because it has five flares, one after the other. It's at a higher redshift, and the statistics is much better than MAGIC. So at the moment, we're engaged in a sort of complicated mating ritual to see whether we can get to analyze the HESS data or not. Violation of the equivalence principle. So here the issue is whether,
So I don't know if you want discussion of this result now or at the end of the talk, but there, I have some queries.
Mr. Chairperson,
it's okay.
We still have 15 minutes.
Go ahead, make my day.
Okay, so if it's, if what you're seeing is violation of Lorentz invariance, and then I have a confusion, but let me start there. If we take an effective field theory point of view, the leading term is a dimension 5 operator. I'm sure I'm saying things you know, most people know. The leading term is a dimension 5 operator. There's a leading Lorentz breaking term. Delta V cross T that could be in the Hamiltonian. And this gives parity breaking effect where one circular polarization of the photons go faster and one circular polarization of the photons go slower. Now, presumably that's, so first of all, that disagrees with the prediction from your model, which is that all the photons go slower and they have higher energy. Yeah,
so you're going to discuss this.
You ruined my talk. No, sorry.
Well, I can shut up now. So that's a kind of first issue. If it's according to some papers, the distinction between breaking of Lorentz invariance and deforming Lorentz invariance is whether you expect to see the effect as parity even or parity on order alpha.
Okay. So we would expect the effect to be parity even. Okay. And I'll just get a couple of minutes to discuss why we think it's parity even. So we do expect it to be parity even. And for just the reasons you just described, we would not describe it in terms of conventional quantum field theory. You notice that I've essentially never talked about quantum field theory in four dimensions.
Right, and you've avoided the use of the words effective field theory. Okay.
Yeah.
So then maybe we should wait until Stefano starts to discuss the theoretical implications. So there are claims that the parity odd effect is excluded to many orders of magnitude past what you're discussing here, but your claim is that's compatible because your effect is parity even.
Sure.
Okay. So maybe it's for a long time.
Basically, it's a different field because they have an even set of energy particles in the game,
yeah.
And that allows you to not fall exactly in effective theory form.
Exactly.
And this is why, basically, you can call it a different test field theory. If they're testing a theory which is not the effective theory in the sense of this, the word, because as this hidden set.
Would it be possible if I just finish off what I wanted to say, and then we're going to have plenty more time to discuss this either at the end or when Stefano gives his talk. Is that okay, Daniel? Okay, so do all relativistic particles have the same velocity? And in our framework, not necessarily if the particle interactions with the space-time foam are non-universal. So this is actually directly related to what Lee just said. Okay, so for us, the two helicities of the photon would have the same interaction, okay, so it's a parity-even effect, but an electron need not necessarily have the same interaction. And so this is also related to these extremely interesting and stringent limits on Lorentz violation that come from things like the Crab Nebula. So indeed, astrophysics gives us constraints on Lorentz violation for electrons, which are just way more more sensitive. So this is just repeating what these things are, but I guess we'll hear in more detail about it tomorrow, so I won't say very much about it. If you believe in the linear modification of Lorentz invariants for electrons, and you've got limits which are, you know, 10 to 26 GeV or something like that, maybe even stronger by now. However,
S over GS. And of course, if you have an extremely weakly capacitor string theory, you can reach it, but of course, you spoil terminology because you don't have such weakly string cap. So, in other words, could even be.
Right.
I mean, it's not, but.
There's various sets of weasel words that one can say.
That's
right. But our particular weasel word would be to say that these limits are extremely interesting, but they do not refer to the photon. At least for character even modification, for modification. And so I think actually Nick already showed you these pictures of something very much similar to that. So the idea is that some particles that propagates interacts with the lead brain, and this interaction modifies the metric, which then gives a modification of the velocity of propagation. In our framework, it's only the photon that does this. Electrons do not, because they carry non-trivial quantum numbers. Okay, got a few more minutes. Maybe I just like to mention a couple of other things. One is that this non-critical string approach is tailor-made for describing inflation. So in conventional inflation, you would say, okay, the Hubble expansion rate is given by the field energy during the inflationary epoch. And you would say there's a horizon. Horizon means information loss. That's the sort of thing that we could describe in our framework. And so indeed, we can describe something like inflation. But for us, it's the departure from criticality of the string theory, which characterizes the Hubble expansion rate. And so we've got a whole bunch of equations to describe this. But basically, the Hubble expansion rate is related to the deviation of the central charge from the critical value. And we have a specific scenario for this, which we wrote down in terms of these D-brains, which Nick has introduced to you, and I'm not going to discuss them anymore. This is in many respects rather similar to these ekpyrotic scenarios for the beginning of the universe, but they're somewhat different because for us the vacuum energy is actually a quantum effect associated with, if you like, some sort of Casimir effect associated with these D-brains. Okay, so there was maybe inflation at some time. There does seem to be dark energy around at the moment, and I think this dark energy is great, right, because it's, you know, a real challenge for string theory in particular, and it's a challenge to which I think traditional critical string theory has not risen with great convincingness, if that's that word. So your basic problem from the point of view of critical string theory, as was discussed in a paper a couple of years ago by Ed Witten, is that if you have constant vacuum energy, then you've got something like the Sitter space, you've got an event horizon, you've got lots of information, you don't have an S matrix. So you have to have some framework for describing this, which goes beyond this S matrix description. That's, of course, what we would claim to have in the form of non-critical string theory. So for us, there's no particular problem with having constant dark energy. And in fact, over the years, together with Dimitri, we've been involved in various different scenarios for non-critical string cosmology, because it always seemed to us that non-critical strings because of this inflation that I discussed earlier on, was somehow the natural framework for discussing cosmology. So I won't discuss this because it's time is moving on. But a couple of years ago, we pointed out that at least in some class of string theories, you could get a departure from criticality, which would be related to the string coupling, and which would have the effect of giving you this dark energy. In fact, in this particular framework, the deceleration parameter of the universe was precisely the string coupling square. Now, this particular scenario, in the very simple form that we originally proposed it, probably doesn't work. Oh, God, another brainy scenario. However, a suitably reinterpreted version of the scenario is compatible with the data, and this is something which we've christened Q cosmology. The Q, the Greek Q cosmology, the green one here. The Q is this non-trivial central charge that I mentioned earlier on, which previously surfaced as related to the Hubble expansion rate in an inflationary scenario. Anyway, you can make Q cosmology models which are compatible with the present data.
This model is like a small Q, is it
constant? Not necessarily constant. In fact, in general, it's not constant. Eventually, it like run down the inflationary hill. Anyway, Nick has recently written a paper with Mitchell where they do a more complete analysis of Q cosmology models. I'm not going to discuss this in great detail. It has the interesting feature that there has to be some sort of negative energy component in contributing to the Hubble expansion rate. Okay, so I finish. I, together with my collaborators, exhort people to think about possible experimental signatures of quantum gravity. I would encourage people to think about distinctive effects which are not allowed in conventional quantum field theory, because otherwise there's always going to be some quantum field theorist that's going to come along and say, I can do that too. So think of something which they couldn't possibly do. As is, I think, painfully obvious, one is only in a position to give a heuristic discussion of such effects. It's just very, very complicated. We don't have enough formal machinery at our disposal. Non-critical string theory is one proposal. It's not complete, but at least it's a possible framework. And I've suggested to you that you think about possible modifications of quantum mechanics, Lorentz invariance, and the equivalence principle, and maybe also testing cosmology. Thank you.
This is probably pretty quick. Could you just say, comment a few words about why you would prefer not to use effects of field theory to help constrain your parameters? Or why you explicitly try to lay that aside?
Well, because in field theory, we have an S matrix. That's the whole point of what we're doing is there is no S matrix. So you would not expect that an effective field theory threshold to be the appropriate one. And specifically, you know, I haven't been able to go through all the technical details I've got, but you know, deeply not to cover the field theory background. Since this is something different, if it's effective field theory, then the field theory would be able to do it.
Why is the violation of Lorentz invariance a signature of quantum gravity? Perhaps the correct quantum gravity theory is Lorentz invariant.
So perhaps the correct quantum gravity theory is?
Is Lorentz invariant?
Ah, well, maybe it is. But what I'm saying is that there is at least some heuristic suggestion that that should not be correct suggestion, at least not in the traditional way that we have thinking about it.
If I understand correctly, the whole point of this gamma ray bursts is to look for a dependence on the distance traveled by the gamma ray burst and the time delay.
Right.
But it seems that to me that you could, even if you see and confirm an effect of that kind, come up with easier explanations. For example, a non-trivial interaction between photons and dark matter spread out in the intervening region would be able to produce something that is proportional to the distance as well. So how would you disentangle or differentiate between something like that, which is, of course, exotic, but not as exotic as the evaluation of Lorentz invariants from the Lorentz invariant?
Yeah, I think it would be that exciting if you found such an effect. The characteristic of such a thing is that it would, the effect would die out if you consider photons which were much more energetic than the mass of the dark matter particle.
Sorry?
The effect would disappear when the dot energy is much larger than the mass of the dark matter particle. In the same way, if you think of the multiplication of a photon, its energy is much, much larger than the mass of the electron. The effect goes away. So I think you'd expect that the effect would go away if the energy of the photon is much larger than the mass of the dark matter.
But making the mass of the dark matter heavier as I need it, I can always limit that, right?
Yeah, I could, right? Eventually, if it becomes as massive as a Planck mass, then it will become formally indistinguishable from our scenario, because in a sense, it's described as something where there are such massive Planck-type particles now. I suspect, though, that the effect you talked about would be way too small, because we get our effect only because there is a Planck density of Planck mass particles. Your dark matter scenario, you could possibly have a Planck density of your cold dark matter particles.
Last question.
When you talked about the seeking meter experiments to test the alpha, beta, and gamma non-quantum mechanical contribution to the non-quantum, these operators utilize CPT. Now, there have been a lot of consequent tests of the CPT using the anti-hydrogen spectroscopy and the coronal mass measurements by meter and by other experiments. Do you know if these meters actually are competitive with the cameras?
Okay, so the limit of the difference between the properties of the proton and antiproton, or more generally, matter and antimatter properties, is in general much less than 10 to the minus 20 or so of every different CPD. They're much coarser constraints. But they are actually very different things, because in our approach, the violation of CPT comes about because of this time non-reversible evolution, right? It's not related to the intrinsic properties of particles. So we would just not expect anything there at all. Actually, not to say those are not interesting things to do, but we wouldn't expect it. As far as the anti-hydrogen is concerned, that is still a hope for the future. So far, the constraints got for the measured properties of anti-hydrogen are very big.
Let's thank the speaker again.